very good. So the fourth lecture, Distinctively Human Mind Reading.
Thank you very much, Ursula, and thanks again to all of you for coming out on a beautiful day for being outside and not being at a philosophy lecture. Okay, so all social animals learn about the world in the company of their fellows. Last time we saw that animals can exploit the learning of their fellow creatures, basically by having some kind of grasp of how this learning works. Some abilities that we classed under the heading mind reading. And we looked in particular at two types of mind reading, perceptual and epistemic. On the side of perception, abilities such as geometrical gaze following, where I'm looking at a facing animal and I register its shift of gaze as pertaining to something behind me, for example, that kind of ability enables you to use other animals, basically as like rear view mirrors or side view mirrors, reflecting patches of reality that are beyond your own personal immediate sensory field. On the epistemic side, competitive animals who are capable of distinguishing between knowledge and ignorance can expect expert behavior from knowledgeable competitors, and they can take advantage of ignorant ones. More generally, a creature who learns that another is knowledgeable can watch it and read its actions for cues about the zone of its knowledge, where these cues are a function not just of what the animal is currently sensing, but of something deeper, what it's learned over time about that patch of reality. And on the flip side of that, recognizing that a certain animal is ignorant of what's going on in an area, as we saw in those primate Gettier cases, that enables you to switch off your attention to the cues of the animal about what's going on in that area. And we're going to see on Monday, it's actually going to turn out to be pretty important that we learn certain generalizations about knowledge and about ignorance somewhat separately, just as we learn certain generalizations about what people can see and about obstructions and barriers somewhat separately. We're going to combine those types of learning in a surprising way on Monday. Where are we now? Okay, the sort of core idea here is that mind reading enables selective social learning. It enables smart switching between following the cues of others and learning to think for and thinking for yourself. We recall from this time last week, I'm sure, that curiosity accelerates individual learning by motivating animals to seek out surprising experiences. We recall from Monday, or from the recap that I just gave, that social cognition accelerates individual learning by enabling animals to harvest some value from each other's current perceptions and stored knowledge. And here's an overview of what we're going to do today. We're going to see that in humans, these two accelerants come together. So alone among the animals, we're actually curious about what others do and don't know. And in fact, we devote large portions of our waking lives to conversational interactions, have no obvious instrumental purpose, seem to be curiosity-driven, and those conversational explorations essentially test and refine our theories about what others know. So just as curiosity-driven spatial exploration enabled those rats to basically build a mental model of their spatial environment, so also curiosity-driven social interaction enables us to map out what others do and don't know. And as a result, in contrast to other animals that just make opportunistic use of each other's intelligence, we make deliberate and strategic use of it. We ask, we question, we inform. Matched with social partners who are doing the same thing, using us as we're using them, we can come to know about reality collegially, building common knowledge. Today, I'm going to draw on research in developmental psychology and conversation analysis to explain how this becomes possible for us. Okay, so another of the things I was talking about last week, if we can remember back that far, was the reinforcement learning, in which agents refine the policies guiding their action in light of reward feedback, whether that feedback is coming from the visceral satisfaction of honey or from the purely mental satisfaction of surprise. Patterns of reward lead to the formation of value functions, which represent the expected reward of an action in a given circumstance. Effective policies intersperse the pragmatic pursuit of reward on the basis of one's existing value function with some measure of exploration to discover undiscovered reward elsewhere, to update the value function. And we remember curiosity is basically qualitative guidance for exploration, making exploration more efficient. For our purposes today, it's going to be helpful to distinguish two types of reinforcement learning, and I direct your attention to our handout model, item one on our handout, model-free and model-based reinforcement learning. We have a little universe with a rat who has some choices to make in this maze. There's three choice points. S1, he can go right or left. S2, if he goes left, he gets cheese. If he goes right, he gets nothing. At state S3, both S2 and S3 being reached from S1, if he goes left, he gets water. If he goes right, he gets carrots. And there's a sense in which model-based reinforcement learning is sort of the easiest thing to talk about. There's this little diagram at the lower left there, and you see it's, he's got a little tree of the various possibilities of action and the ultimate payoffs that they lead to. And you know, he could think strategically about what sequence of turns he should make if he's thirsty, that kind of thing. It can be very sort of taxing and cumbersome to work with enormous trees all the time. And most of the time when we're kind of, you know, walking around and doing stuff, we are not doing that. We are not, you know, identifying all the possible actions and all the possible choice points that that lie ahead of us. That would be rather overwhelming. We're doing something that looks a lot more like that habitual behavior of model-free reinforcement learning. So if you run this maze many, many, many times when you're hungry and you prefer cheese to carrots, you're going to end up with the valuation scheme that you're seeing in that little zone there. Basically what happens is when you're hungry in state one, turning left is just represented as having a value of 4. Turning right is having a value of 3. You're going to be inclined to turn left. That cached value is actually representing basically like what's the best thing that could happen if I go along that way. And so since the value of turning left is sort of cached at the point of decision, you don't have to be thinking ahead, right? Where are we? Okay, I could talk about this for a long time. But let me just say, many animals, including rats, are capable of both ways of thinking because model-free reinforcement learning stores values for particular state action pairings. It allows for really easy but inflexible action when familiar states are visited. So driving home on mental autopilot, I take my usual route, switching lanes when triggered by the sight of the exit sign. Model-based reinforcement learning allows more taxing but flexible on-the-spot updates. Having heard on the radio that my exit is closed for bridge repair, I simulate my options using a mental map and I take an earlier exit, maybe for the first time. So you can use a model to simulate possible experiences. Big differences between these two ways of thinking come out when the environment changes in some way. So if you're put down in that environment and you're thirsty and you've never explored that that zone, that maze thirsty before, you'll still feel some kind of inclination to turn left because turning left has always paid off in the past. So that's sort of pain. And, you know, in our daily lives, of course, these things can come into conflict. You're, you know, all strategically planning to stop at the bakery on your way home from work and you kind of get engrossed in your podcast on the way home and you find yourself arriving at your front door without any bread. And that's like just your lazy model-free system has taken over. Okay, I like the way Peter Dayan characterizes the contrast between model-free and model-based control. He describes it as really a contrast between imperatives and declaratives. So model-free control is kind of procedural in character. It specifies directly the choice of action at each state or location as an imperative command. Model-based control, that was quote, that's on your handout. Model-based control, quote, provides a set of semantic facts about the structure of the environment and the subject in the form of a forward or generative model. And ideally, those facts are going to entail that some particular action is optimal and that will solve your problem. So the way I would put it as an epistemologist is to say that model-free agents can often know what to do, given their training and what they're now observing. And model-based agents can know what is the case in a more detached way. Successful model-based reinforcement learning results in states that are not just accurate, but robustly accurate. Because incorrect predictions frustrate the pursuit of reward, models tend to improve over time. The idea here is certainly not that everything the agent incorporates in its model is going to constitute knowledge, especially early in training. You can expect the agent to have a lot of misconceptions in there. The idea is rather knowledge is the natural endpoint towards this kind of system, towards which this kind of system will gravitate in a suitably regular environment, et cetera. Knowledge is like the basin of attraction towards which the agent's representations should ultimately converge. Safely accurate representations will be stabilized by their propensity to ensure the capture of reward. So, in model-based learning, the agent is using its observations to construct a model of the environment where observations are just a signal of the underlying state of the environment. We're now going to talk about this kind of environment and not the artificially simple tic-tac-toe environments of last week where state and signal are just the same. So reinforcement learning is just going to extract reward extract reward-relevant differences in those underlying states. So basically, every time I drive home from my undergraduate campus in the suburbs, the sensory stream of observations I receive is somewhat different. There's like slightly different traffic patterns, illumination, cloud cover. I'm in a slightly different lane position as I'm driving. For the purpose of efficient navigation, a learned model of the roads will not retain all those variations. It's just going to distill whatever features really make a difference to successful travel. A useful mental map might distinguish the states of being on the main highway and being on the side access road without further distinguishing states involving small differences in cloud cover or illumination. A model whose state space is too fine-grained will tax the memory and processing capacities of the agent and impede the effective evaluation of actions. Like at the limit, it's going to make you kind of take every trip as if it's your first, because the clouds have never been exactly this way before, and I've never left at 7:06 a.m., you know. On the other hand, a model that's too coarse-grained is going to bar the agent from taking advantage of some reward-relevant differences. So if your model like strips out all time-of-day information, you might never learn that morning rush, it's better to take the side road. Models that start out coarse-grained can later be refined, for example, at the age of 4 for human beings, when key distinctions are learned. So model-based spatial navigation is an accomplishment. Rats can master it. I guess it's not like a huge accomplishment, but it takes them some time. It takes them quite a bit of that curiosity-driven exploration. Remember, they're sort of avidly going all over, even though they're not being fed in the maze. They'll cross these electrocuted floors to check it all out. It takes them a while to build the kind of mental map that's going to enable them to, for example, take new shortcuts if certain routes are blocked. It's the kind of action that could come in handy later if they're chased by a predator and a tree falls or whatever. When they have successfully mapped the zone, we see a sudden upward spike in their spike. We see a rise in their maze performance, right? There's a sort of jump upwards when you've got model-based learning. Whereas model-free learning, by contrast, slow and steady progression, pretty much a sloping line. The longer you live in a certain area, gradually the better your habits become for navigating it. No big jump when, hey, now I've got the model. The model just came online. Having a model in place, of course, as we say, doesn't remove the possibility of habitual action. When you're taxed, you go back to autopilot. Spatial navigation is one domain in which animals switch between model-free and model-based control. But there's other task domains which allow similar switches between habitual and strategic action. There could also be domains in which humans can act strategically and animals can only act habitually. And I'm going to argue that today that mind reading is an area like that. I think there's a bunch of evidence for this in animal behavior. For example, non-human animals, notoriously weak at strategic deception. They have all kinds of functional deception, right, with their camouflage and their weird broken wing displays and so on. But those seem to be sort of hardwired. There's no good evidence. So this is in the Martin and Santos paper, which I think is actually from last time. They say the tactical deception literature, at least to date, has no evidence that primates attempt to mislead competitors by actively giving them false information, by inculcating a false belief. So that's, I think, one sign they're not doing model-based mentalizing. But what I really want to talk about today is humans. So let's get into that. So we'll start again with the perceptual, and then we'll do the epistemic. Human gaze following begins with a sensitivity to direction of gaze. So infants between the ages of 2 and 6 months are sensitive to which way an agent is facing. But it takes a while for this to develop. And even at 8 months of age, children will follow an adult's head turn regardless of whether the eyes are open or closed. But then, at 9 months of age, 9 to 10 months of age, there's a sudden huge jump in performance. This is called the nine-month revolution, Brooks and Meltzoff. And comparable timelines, chimpanzees and monkeys, just show slow, steady, gradual improvement. They never get a revolution. They just get gradual increases in competence with more complex sight lines, issues with obstructions, doors and windows, and so on, up to the age of 5. They never show much sensitivity to the difference between head direction and eye direction. So, you know, they can't do these things where, you know, your head's over here, but you're looking that way. That's hard for them. We're really good at it, and it's not fair because we have an anatomical advantage. So if you look at the picture, we have the so-called cooperative eye, and this is Kobayashi and Kashima. The human eye is elongated. We've got that sharply contrasting white sclera around the iris. Other primates have round eyes with a darkened sclera, similar in color to the iris or to the face. So basically, gaze direction is camouflaged in all other primates, and it's emphasized in us. And conspicuous gaze direction gives both your competitors and your predators a predictive advantage in figuring out what you're going to do. So it's like a really interesting question, why we have lost that measure of privacy. Advocates of the cooperative eye hypothesis have urged that the compensating value of our easily read gaze direction lies in its facilitation of mental state sharing, which is crucial for creatures that are cooperative as opposed to competitive. So the king of this movement is, of course, Michael Tomasello. And there's a quote from him on this point on your handout. He says, quote, "Whereas during competition, individuals read the minds of their competitors against the competitor's will." You know, you want poker face, right, if you're competing. "In cooperation and coordination, individuals want their partner to read their minds. When we're cooperating and coordinating, I do everything I can to display or advertise my mental states to you to facilitate the process." So as Tomasello goes on to emphasize, the remarkably flexible coordination of humans is enabled by our communicative powers, which have a foundation beginning in the interactive alignment of attention, initially through pointing and gaze following. So humans not only find it easier to read the direction in which other members of their kind happen to be gazing, what we do is we actively manipulate each other's direction of gaze and then their attention more broadly. And remember I said last time there's like one weird trick that sets us apart from the animals? That's it. It's that we're not just noticing which way they're looking, we're making them look. We're seizing their mental states and trying to command them. We're doing this back and forth in each other. So across cultures, infants begin to use a hand or finger to point out objects to their caregivers between 10 and 14 months of age, often echoing the pointing gestures of their caregivers. They start getting receptive to pointing gestures at that nine-month revolution, but they start producing them a month later, right? And they look back and forth between the object and the caregiver. By contrast, chimpanzees don't communicate with each other by pointing, and you have to go through enormous training to get them to respond appropriately to the pointed gestures of cooperative humans in hidden reward games. So that's Pavanelli's classic work, where if you do pointed gestures, hidden reward games with 12-month-old infants, they get it right away. There are domesticated animals, including goats and dogs, that respond to pointing cues. Dogs actually can even enlist the help of a human owner by alternating gaze at the object they want and the owner, right? But they're missing a key part of human information sharing. So in dogs, the alternation of gaze, that actually seems to be a learned behavior instrumental to the attainment of a reward, right? So it could just be like moving around. They've discovered, oh, I can get him to do this by, you know, doing that. And actually, alternatively, some people think this is McCloskey. Think it could be, it could just manifest sort of learned expectations about what will happen, with the dog repeatedly looking back at the owner to see whether he's started to move yet towards giving it the reward. Key, there's no evidence that the gaze alteration diminishes if the human looks in the right direction. The dog's goal throughout is just to be given the food reward, not to enter into that state of shared attention. And for humans, entering into a state of shared attention, even if it doesn't result in getting a sausage, that's rewarding in itself. We interactively align our attention on objects without any clear ulterior motives. So just for one illustration, we can look at this cross-cultural study of infant pointing behavior. This is run by Elf Laskowski and colleagues. And they're working with children around the one-year mark from really different communities. So they've got rural children from a subsistence farming community in Papua New Guinea. They have kids from downtown daycare in Kyoto, Japan. They have some children from an industrial community in Atlantic Canada. And it's the world's simplest study. They just leave infant and caregiver dyads alone in a room with stuff in it for 5 minutes. That's basically it. I mean, they told them at the end, just put the stuff back. Don't take it with you. That's basically all they did. They did not make any mention of pointing in their instructions. But video recordings showed infants and caregivers of all surveyed cultures pointing items out to each other. Where am I? A gesture is, and if you think, oh yeah, I've been with a toddler, they're grabby, right? It's not like that, because a gesture only gets coded as a point if it's accompanied by a corresponding look and only if it was not part of an act of touching or grasping an object or an attempt to do so. Across cultures, researchers found enough turn-taking and pointing, that is, there's a leading point, following point to the same object, to suggest what they call, quote, a conversation-like structure in pre-linguistic gestural communication. So gazing and ostension anchor participants in the real world. You can only see or point to something that's publicly present. Agents who are actively pointing things out to each other gain direct feedback for their models of who can see what. Of what's visible for others. And that's feedback that's unavailable for animals who are just like passively watching each other look at things and respond to things. And animals that are not intervening on states of sight, they're just observing them. Okay, patterns of showing and sharing reactions to an object seem to be unique to humans. But other primates come tantalizingly close. So chimpanzee infant caregiver dyads do engage in mutual gaze with each other. And we know from last time chimpanzees are capable of gaze following. They just don't integrate those behaviors. You don't see patterns of triadic engagement between agents in a shared object. And they actually just also fail to respond to human trainers' repeated efforts to spark that kind of interaction. A chimpanzee will move into another's field of view or provoke another to look at him, but he won't provoke another to look at some third object. Apes communicate in two ways, through vocalizations like alarm calls, which seem to be typically involuntary, and through manual gestures, right? The manual gestures are directed and controlled. They're under agency. Elizabeth Warren and colleagues have noted that apes use attention-getting moves prior to their deliberate gestures, down to like poking the other guy with a stick, in fact. But and that's to like ensure that the gesture gets seen. This is getting really close to showing behavior. So with joint attention, you can initiate it by pointing at an object. You can initiate it also with holding out the object for the other person to look at. And it seems like, you know, poking someone to show them your gesture, that's getting really close to the holdout gesture kind of structure. I'm going to say one way in which I think it falls short is that ape gestures are all imperatives. They're not declaratives. So there's a sense in which, like, poking someone and then showing them your gesture, right, that is so procedural. It's like you see the stimulus, you do this thing. It's trying to manipulate or control what they do, right? As opposed to the holdout gesture, which seems to be eliciting a reaction. I want to know what you think of this, right? It's a manipulation of attention, sure, but it's got the function of better controlling the witnessing animal's behavior rather than cooperatively supplying it with information. So, I don't know what you think, but I think when I look at these stimuli from the Laskowski study, I'm saying, don't those look like the kind of stimuli that engage the attention of curious animals, right? They've got that kind of novelty, the feather boa, the balloon, the flashing lights. We recall from last week, curious animals experience reward for surprising events, where an event is surprising, when it runs contrary to expectation. It can't just be novel. It's got to be you have some expectations which are violated. Because basic animal mechanisms for learning are prediction error correction mechanisms, we learn when our expectations are violated. The active prediction error seeking forces of curiosity are really kind of grinding against those prediction error correction forces of learning in a constructively adversarial fashion to accelerate knowledge gain in the solo animal. So basically, like, the curious animal is strengthening its world model by challenging it. What's unique about humans, I feel like I have to look at Nick Shea as I say this. What's unique about humans, Nick, as you know, is that we share our curiosity with each other. So it's not just that we register private surprise at a novel item, which a chimpanzee will do as well. We vocalize our surprise overtly. Oh, right? Other animals aren't doing that. So basically, you can double your fun with a surprising item that you've seen by drawing it to the attention of another and watching their reaction. A pair of humans who actively engage in surprising each other can make rapid gains, moving towards common knowledge by actively seeking out anything that will produce violation of expectancy in either of them. Actually, I often think of, like, philosophy question periods are like that. You've got your theory. I've got my surprise and counterexample, right? We're going to antagonize each other and learn so much. Okay, and we can even get strategic about this. Because humans vocalize their surprise overtly, you can come to know over time what kinds of things surprise others, both in general and in ways that are particular to the kind of person that you're dealing with. If you're suitably reactive, I can also gain by showing you things that surprise you to trigger a reaction that I'll find interesting, even if the thing in question doesn't really surprise me anymore at this point. So if this behavior is showing up in small-scale societies in Papua New Guinea and also in downtown Kyoto, I think it seems to be secured as some kind of part of human nature. So we need an explanation of how this kind of interaction is an evolutionarily stable strategy for us and also why other animals aren't doing it. Because if it's so great, why isn't everybody doing it? Why aren't the rats showing each other stuff? Hey, check this out, buddy. Okay, so let's try. I feel like now it's a part of the talk where I'm on really thin ice, so bear with me. Okay, given that we have to have prior expectations in order to violate them, individual curiosity can drive this kind of social behavior only among agents who have a broad but not unmanageable array of possible reactions, right? That was the lesson from the Schmidhuber television set example from last Wednesday, that if you've got this screen that's broadcasting like totally freaky random static, it's just not surprising because you don't have any expectations. It's very novel every millisecond, but it's also very boring because you have no expectations. Okay, so we need like a range of reactions that's going to be challenging but not unmanageable. Okay, there's two directions here that we got to talk about. And the first one I'm not so great about, but anyway, I'll just say it because I've got something written down. Okay, by showing them surprising objects, caregivers can elicit emotional reactions in the infant, which may be appropriately hard for caregivers to predict because infants have this sort of inchoate understanding of the world. Like, it is honestly really funny to see how infants react to novel objects. The other direction strikes me as so much less problematic, so much easier. Infants can elicit appraisals and namings of objects by the caregiver. Notice, infants actually don't engage in joint attention with each other. They need a more expert partner to play this game. It's only around age 4, conversational language use, when we get that second bump in the model, that you get joint attention between children. Before that, if you've seen toddlers, you know, they just kind of engage in that kind of more parallel play. Okay, so research on declarative pointing infants were participants, so it's kind of research by them in a sense. Nothing about us without us. Around the 1-year mark shows that caregivers are highly responsive to children's pointing. So at least in one-on-one free play contexts, virtually all infant pointing gets some form of maternal response. So a typical study puts it at 97%. That's the Olson, Janet Olson in Missouri, 2011. That includes, the 97% response to pointing includes nonverbal nodding and giving. And if what you're showing is proto-declarative pointing as opposed to reaching, then specifically verbal responses really dominate. So you get verbal responses 93% of the time if the infant comes up with a proto-declarative point at something. This verbal response usually includes some kind of labeling. So Olson Missouri finds 62% of responses include at least one object, action, or internal state label. And that's really close to the numbers other people are getting. Hayday Marcus got 65% of the time. Those internal state labels, I was going to put that in quotation marks because I'm like, seeing is not an internal state, am I right? Anyway, the internal state labels virtually always reference seeing for pointing gestures and wanting for reaching gestures. The mother's lexicalization of the mental state, oh, you see the balloon, could be further consolidating the child's understanding of that mental state. And Mele Tomopo and Ted Ruffman have done some great work on that if you want to follow it up. One really nice feature of labels in a natural language is that the fixed lexicon generates expectations. But for a child in a period of rapid vocabulary growth, it's attractively dicey whether you've heard the word before or not, right? Doggy, you know, maybe it's not quite a doggy, maybe it's something a little different. Rates of maternal labeling in response to pointing are very unsurprisingly correlated with infant vocabulary, both in the moment and predictably. Infant pointing on its own is a significant predictor of vocabulary size, with maternal responsiveness enhancing this effect. That's kind of not so surprising. I actually think all that focus on vocabulary and labeling in developmental psychology sometimes obscures a simpler mechanism that's at work here. You might be wondering what goes on in the maternal verbal responses to declarative pointing that do not include a labeling of the object, action, or internal state. What is mom saying if she's not hitting one of those boxes? And you have to crawl on your hands and knees through the methodological notes to find out what they've cut. But here's a clue. This is from the methodological note from that Cameron Faulkner cross-cultural study on commonalities in children's pointing and maternal responsiveness. It's actually a really, really great article, so I'm being a little mean. But here's what they cut. Quote, utterances containing only single word expressives or fillers, e.g., oh, hey, uh-oh, were not included in the analysis, as the maternal utterances analysis focused only on linguistic items with semantic content. And my reaction to that particular methodological decision is, uh-oh. Because, like, the decision to strip out, oh, it's pretty dismaying for our purposes because that's the default expression of surprise in English. It's very heavily used. It shows up more than once a minute in adult conversation. That's that big new candor corpus, the Rees 2023. To the best of my knowledge, there's still no work on developmental psychology on the use of O in infant caregiver interaction. I tried to get something started before the pandemic. I'll do it now. Over in sociology, research in conversation analysis take it to be a marker of epistemic change of state. And its most common conversational use signals knowledge gain. That's a function first clearly identified by sociologist John Heritage. We'll be looking at that work a little more after we examine the second big jump in mind reading competence, which happens, and this is something that sets us apart from other animals. This happens at about 4 years of age when children get the capacity for belief attribution. And humans are distinct in this, right? Other primates treat any state short of knowledge as undifferentiated ignorance. Humans recognize meaningful distinctions between those who are mistaken, those who are coincidentally right, those who haven't formed any opinion. The mature human capacity to attribute belief affords remarkable advantages in predicting behavior as well as enabling specifically human forms of social interaction, including strategic deception, argumentative persuasion. Given that the emergence of belief attribution marks a deeper understanding of mental states, a natural question to ask is whether this new understanding enhances or supplants the knowledge-centered framework available to other species. You might even wonder whether human mind reading could somehow be based on belief from the start, with knowledge attribution appearing for us as an elaboration. I think that humans also start by thinking in terms of knowledge and then graduate to thinking in terms of belief as well. And until recently, my project was really encumbered by a string of publications arguing for implicit sensitivity to false belief in infants. But I'm just going to set that aside because I think it's increasingly clear that that work is really not replicating. Happy to talk about it in question period if you feel otherwise. If we look at the main sequence of milestone tasks extracted from several decades of developmental research led above all by Henry Wellman, we can find a clear progression, which starts with goals and desires. So we already 18-month-old toddlers can show they recognize the desires of target agents when those desires are different from their own. They have different goals. After that comes the so-called diverse belief task, which actually does not get the child to infer that agents have diverse beliefs. It's a very misleading label. If you want an argument that children pass that task without doing any belief reasoning whatsoever, I recommend Mind Reading and Conversation by Evan Westra and myself, 2021. You can look at what's wrong with the task. There's a really robust progression from passing the knowledge access task, this is ages 3 and 4, to passing the false belief task about a year later, when belief reasoning really begins. So between 3 and 4 years of age, children can make accurate judgments of ignorance or lack of knowledge. For example, when they see that an agent is deceived, but they're unable to express the particular false belief that the deceived agent will have, unable to predict what that agent will do. And across cultures, children do not systematically pass the explicit false belief task until ages 4 to 5. And that is an extremely robust result. Hundreds of studies, thousands of participants. There's various versions of the knowledge access task. So some ask about pairs of agents, one of whom lifts or kicks a container while the other actually looks inside, with full marks awarded if knowledge is attributed only to the one who has seen inside. Explicit false belief tasks also have a great variety of forms, including the unexpected transfer task that we talked about last time, and also the unexpected contents task, where you have a familiar container, in this country perhaps a Smarties tube. You still get Smarties in tubes here, yeah? And it may have the Smarties removed and paper clips placed inside. And it's a remarkably difficult task for younger children. They struggle even to report their own prior false belief in situations where they themselves have just been deceived. They don't answer randomly. They tend to over-attribute knowledge to others and to their past selves. They report that the deceived child will give the right answer about the hidden contents. That, you know, a naive child walking into the room will say that there's paper clips in this container. The transition from failing it to passing it, failing it at 3, passing it at 5, really robust result. But as with last time, you might wonder, look, is the problem with the task really a problem about belief representation as such, or is it a problem with falsity? Because it's now that you know that there's paperclips in the tube, it could just be hard for you to project to another a picture of the world which differs from the way in which you know that the world actually is. Because you have to kind of quarantine that representation of how the world is not alongside your representation of how it is, and that's, you know, there's executive demands in doing that. So, once again, get your cases to the rescue, right? Because there you've got accidentally true belief without knowledge. And William Fabricius and colleagues have explored a number of cases of this type. And so I think if children can explain and predict the behavior of knowledgeable agents, but not the behavior of those who have accidentally true beliefs, that's evidence that belief as such is hard to represent. So in Fabricius's Gettier version of the unexpected contents task, the experimenter shows the child a familiar brand name candy package. He's American, so he uses M&Ms, and asks the child to say what it contains. The child is then shown that the package contains not the expected candy, but very disappointingly, a pencil. However, and this is the key twist, the experimenter then removes the pencil in front of the child and fills the bag with the appropriate brand of candy. The child is then asked the following questions. What did we put inside the bag? What was in the bag first? Those are the controls. And then the story. And virtually all children pass those controls. I have a friend waiting outside the room. It's Elmo. He hasn't seen inside this bag. When he first looks at the bag, before he opens it, will he think there are M&Ms or a pencil inside? And then the follow-up, why will Elmo think that? So there's a very interesting developmental pattern in responses to that belief question. So the youngest children in the study generally answer accurately and say that Elmo will say there's candy in the bag. Performance worsens. By 4.5 years of age, they're worse than chance, and it doesn't get back up to ceiling until they're 6 years old. And the performance dip is really weird, because why is it so hard for kids to report that Elmo will say there's candy in a bag which has M&Ms all over the outside and candy inside it, right? And it's, and the child herself has just said that there initially that there's candy in there. Okay. I think the results only make sense if you look at the answers that the children give to that justification question. Why will Elmo say that? So the youngest children largely ventured what Josef Pirner calls reality reasoning when they're asked why Elmo thinks what he does. So they often reply in terms of the hidden state of the world, specifically the, why will Elmo think that? He'll think that because there's M&Ms inside. Or sometimes they would say, he'll think that because he wants them. So they're thinking about like kind of the goals of the of Elmo and the reality that's there. I think you also see in those responses some big over attribution of knowledge, which is something you're getting from that earlier age group. The group in the middle, the oldest group, they're fine. They'll say things like, they'll do clearly belief based reasoning. They'll say it has M&Ms on it. It's an M&Ms bag. The group in the middle tends to reason in terms of what Fabricius labels perceptual access, and they really reference a failure to see or know. So they'll say, he didn't see where you put the M&Ms. He won't know M&Ms are there. He doesn't know, so he'll have to guess. Consistent with the researcher's hypothesis that children associate ignorance with error, roughly half the children in the middle group predicted that Elmo would be mistaken about the contents of the bag, taking it to contain a pencil, or in a few cases, candy and a pencil. That could be a sign, like remember the Y-shaped tube task we're talking about, that you're getting kind of flustered with your decoupled content. Strikingly, even among children who answered the belief question accurately, the absence of knowledge could be really salient in responses to the justification question. This is across all ages. So child one, he hasn't looked inside. He doesn't know what's inside. He won't know if it's a pencil or not. Child two, he doesn't know what it is. Child three, he doesn't know if it's M&Ms or a pencil. Child four, he'll think maybe M&Ms, because there could be M&Ms and there could not be. I love that kid, right? Okay, for adults capable of reasoning in terms of beliefs, the task here is trivial. So it takes some ingenuity to figure out, like, why is this so hard for four-year-olds? Fabricius and colleagues take their results to point to a stage in development at which children reason in terms of knowledge and its absence without yet being able to reason in terms of belief. And I think they're right about that. They go on to elaborate with some perceptual access heuristic stuff, which doesn't square with testimonial knowledge acquisition stuff. So I'm going to set their solution aside. I think the basic first move they do is right. Kids can think about knowledge, they can't think about belief at that age. But I want to emphasize something that I think Fabricius and colleagues don't emphasize enough, which is that kids in this middle bracket, they're not entirely failing at mental state attribution. Despite their strange answers to the question of what Elmo will think, candy and a pencil, the kids are not wrong to see Elmo as lacking knowledge. Although the package does contain the appropriate candy when Elmo's expected to enter the room, the experimentalist has just been tampering with its contents. In general, the inference from bulging M&M's packaging to M&M's is a safe one, but the recent history of this particular bag creates a live risk of error, local error. If Elmo had entered just a moment ago when the child herself first inspected the bag, he would have been mistaken to judge it to contain M&M's. The child has just learned that a superficial glance at this particular bag, that's insufficient to gain knowledge of what it contains. Given just what meets the eye in the moment, there could be M&Ms and there could not be. So I think this is actually kind of like a fake barn Gettier case. Thinking about Elmo's relationship to this particular bag of candy, the kid who observes, he doesn't know if it's M&Ms or a pencil. That kid is getting it right and getting deeper into Elmo's perspective than the younger child who says, Elmo will think that the bag contains M&Ms because it does or because he wants them. So I think belief-centered accounts of the development of theory of mind are really hard-pressed to explain these findings. So this is the kind of account that people like Alan Leslie are pushing. They think kids reason in terms of belief from very early age, but they're failing the false belief task because they rely on the true belief default, according to which, quote, because people's mundane beliefs are usually true, the best guess about another person's belief is that it is the same as one's own. Leslie sees young children's failures on false belief tasks as, and remember, the kids are answering those control questions fine. They have no problem with the bag now contains candy, right? So Leslie sees young children failing because they've got this limited capacity to inhibit that true belief default. But the Gettier cases don't require any such inhibition, so it's hard for such a view to explain why they're difficult. The tasks actually even underscore the relevant fact, the relevant truth. So these cases really look like a problem for people who think it's belief all the way down. A final line of objection to belief-centered views comes from children's early competence in evaluating agents who are better positioned than they are. So three-year-olds can already judge that the agent who's looked inside a container will know what's inside, for example, the identity or color of some hidden object there. When that was, the hiding event happened out of the child's view. So that's Brad Pillow, 1989. Not having formed a belief of her own, the child can't be inferring that the observed agent has a belief that's the same as hers. At the same age, when faced with two agents, one of whom's looked into a box, the other of whom has simply lifted it, children can not only accurately attribute knowledge WH of the contents of the box to the agent who's seen inside, but they're also adept at answering the question, who can tell what's in the box? So knowledgeable agents are positioned to fill gaps in the child's own knowledge of reality, very powerful incentive for mind reading. Really great paper by Aboudi and colleagues on the reference list on that one, too. So if you're convinced that belief detection emerges well after knowledge detection, you can wonder how and why humans ever become capable of thinking about belief. So following the 9-month revolution, infants diverge from other animals in making seeing into a social activity. Hey, check this out. Let's look at it together. Actively directing each other's perceptual states, pointing to visible objects, watching the reactions of others, responding to others' points by looking at the relevant objects and reacting. Caregivers' verbal reactions to declarative pointing spur vocabulary growth, and soon toddlers can direct a caregiver's attention onto an object by naming it. So in the Carpenter and Gall paper, pointing really rises up till about 15 months, and then it slopes off, levels off, not because they're not trying to engage in joint attention, but because they're using words to draw attention. Unlike pointing, naming is not restricted to objects in the deictic sphere of the conversation. The emergence of language creates the possibility of directing attention to past, future, and hypothetical objects and events. So we know from last time that corvids and non-human primates are not restricted to evaluating just each other's sight lines on the here and now. They can also evaluate knowledge and ignorance of things that don't currently meet the eye, like buried worms, hidden lemons. However, just as their knowledge of seeing is acquired strictly from passive observation and not by active intervention, so also their knowledge of knowledge. By contrast, humans ask and inform each other deliberately. And as a function of this interactive conversational engagement, we take the next big step away from other animals. Knowing becomes a social activity for us. So we know things together in common knowledge, just as we see things together in joint attention. I need water. The importance of active engagement in human theory of mind is not always recognized. So Mark Ho, Rebecca Sachs, and Fairi Cushman draw attention to this fact in a recent paper of theirs, Planning with Theory of Mind. And it starts with this long string of quotations from major figures in the field who are all explaining that the core function of mind reading is to predict the behavior of other agents by inferring mental states. However, Ho and colleagues object, quote, this is like saying that a theory of cooking is useful mostly for guessing what's coming out of the kitchen. Theories are useful not only for passively predicting the future, but also for actively planning to change it. Just as we can plan and cook a meal, we can use theory of mind to plan to change other people's actions and feelings by intervening on their perceptions, beliefs, and desires. So they propose that in humans, theory of mind is a unified causal model. The bulk of their paper is devoted to showing how only such a model would be sufficient both to guide action, unlike non-causal predictive models formed by association, and also to issue predictions, unlike model-free habitual responding, of the type that maybe we're seeing in that northern bald ibis's gaze alignment movement. They're really focused on the end result in that paper, but I want to focus on what's necessary for the development of the model. So just as curious agents can gain by showing an object to others and seeing their reactions, they can also gain by telling others something and hearing their reactions. So when we are conversing out of curiosity rather than for some instrumental purpose, and I'm just going to be really clear, I grant we have conversations for instrumental purposes. I have worked as a cashier. But when I'm conversing out of curiosity, which I would rarely get to do as a cashier, I will be motivated to tell you something surprising, that is, something you don't already know, to get more of a reaction from you. You will never guess this thing I heard. Okay. This brings us back to conversation analysis, which we touched on briefly earlier in connection with the theory that O is the most common signal of knowledge gain. This makes sense of in the context of our larger picture, where surprise as the violation of expectation is a proxy for knowledge gain because we learn from expectancy violation. This is not to say that like what makes you say, oh, has to be shocking. You can be like 50-50 on, you know, whether the bathroom is down the hall to the left or the right. And after asking for directions, you still acknowledge the reply with, oh, thanks. That's called the sequence closing use of O, and it functions as a receipt for information received. We are the only animal that does that. We're the only animal that issues receipts for information received. And in lecture six, we're going to try to crack into common knowledge harder, and we'll look at more stuff in conversation analysis. O is part of the back channel of communication. It's part of this set of responsive utterances, instinctively produced by an addressee without taking over the turn of talk. We produce these responses without typically having reflective awareness of their function. And to get a sharper sense of that function, it's instructive to think of contexts in which O is not used. For example, when you ask your students a pedagogical question, it's obvious to everybody that you know the reply. When they produce a reply, you say, yes, that's right. You don't go, oh, typically. I say, yes, very good. And that's exactly because you're not wanting to signal that you're gaining knowledge. Sometimes you are. Oh, God, I hadn't thought of that. Those are always the greatest moments in teaching, right? And of course, you can be duplicitous in your use of, oh, you know, saving face for somebody who's telling you some gossip. In fact, you already know. It's like, oh, well, right. But that usage is parasitic on the primary function to signal knowledge gain. There's other back-channel devices that include such traffic signals as the generic mm-hmm, which gives the speaker the green light to continue their turn. The channel's heavily used, although it's under-transcribed in standard corpora. There's some great new resources lately. I really want to recommend the Candor Corpus, which dropped in 2023, over 7 million words of naturalistic conversation in video format. Thank you, pandemic. And it's enhanced with algorithmic tools for turn segmentation and back-channel analysis. And so the developers of this corpus find about 1,000 words of back-channel for every hour of conversation. These back-channel words are just giving your, this the addressee giving the speaker a little heads up on like what's new to me and what's not, right? Where am I? So back-channel is produced on about 2/3 of conversational turns that are 5 words or more. O is the third most common after yeah and mm-hmm. And you can get a sense of the contrast between yeah and oh. You don't usually think about this, but you put things side by side. If you compare dialogues 1 and 2 on your handout, I'll just give you a second to read that. My feeling about this is that the party comes as news to Bob, but not to Brad, right? I don't know if you're getting that as well. Okay, and I'll stick to English here, but there's back-channel devices in all languages that have basically the same kind of function, although they are, of course, more complicated in the Finnish language. They have so many particles. We do a lot of work with prosodic lamination. Oh, and in Finnish you'd have like, yeah, whatever. Anyway, I've suggested that we actively tell our addressees what they don't already know as a device to get more of a reaction from them for the satisfaction of our own curiosity. Of course, there's a lot more going on in conversational dynamics, not least some reciprocity-related motivation to interest and to be interested. And there's great cross-cultural work on that in Vittorio Tantucci's work. We also converse for instrumental purposes, but the curiosity-driven model of conversation does so much to explain otherwise puzzling aspects of human language use. If you think of how much time every day you spend in language activities, including watching Netflix, we spend a great deal of time talking to each other. It's been estimated at 1/3 of our waking hours are spent in conversation, and we're producing roughly 16,000 words a day on an average day, and it's not obvious what we gain from this. Like Thomas Sello, well, I mean, in my case, sure, but no, Thomas Sello has argued, look, the evolutionary value of language is that it enables us to coordinate our actions and so on. And it's like, yeah, that's great, but very little conversational time is taken up with practical plans. The average human vocabulary also needlessly large, outrageously large for mundane practical coordination of activities. And that's something he should be concerned to explain because it's a burden to rack it all up. Vows of silence are incredibly rare, right? And I think Jean-Louis Dessalles' work on this I find extremely interesting. His positive theory is very, very strange, but all his negative remarks against other theories I think work very well. And so a lot of sort of social signaling theories of why we engage in so much conversation don't give you the right predictions about how widespread communication is and how inconsequential our gossip is. And DeSalle is also very good at pointing out we tend to focus on abnormal or surprising events even when you're having those conversations about the weather. It's like, oh, it's exceptionally fine for this time of year or something like that to do that. Anything with the potential to surprise. Okay, so just as curiosity-driven, oh my God, sorry, I don't have too much left. Just as curiosity-driven spatial exploration in rats, for example, supports the development of model-based spatial navigation, so also curiosity-driven conversation exploration supports the development of a model of what others do and don't know. The model can be used for strategic purposes later, if you need to find something out or if you need to persuade somebody. An interesting feature of model-based cognition is that models can be inverted. Having developed a map of the epistemic and motivational states giving rise to someone's actions, including their speech actions, you can use that model to predict what they'll say and do and what questions they'll be able to answer. But you can also invert the model to infer the epistemic or motivational state that makes sense of an observed action. So this idea that theory of mind is basically inverse reinforcement learning, that is Julian Jara Ettinger, although he has some reservations about the fact that most IRL approaches are using probability distributions to model belief, and he thinks that's not particularly compatible with human mentalizing. If you go to instead to a binary state framework, you can say that, for example, when you detect factive mental states, one of the things you can do is invert the model to infer a state of the world. So, like, Martha knows where the cake is. If you want to find out where the cake is, you watch what she does when she wants cake. So we recall that models can be used to generate simulated experience. For example, when you're weighing your choices of how to get home on hearing about a roadblock. Accordingly, we can simulate the experience that would make sense of someone's otherwise puzzling action. Why are they reaching into that empty container? That would make sense if he knew that the reward were located there. And because you can invert the model, you can see or simulate that experience. You can see him as believing that this is the case. So this simulated experience, you're using your model to simulate the experience, that's decoupled content. And it's distinct from our primary representation of reality. It's simulated off the model. Without decoupling, mind readers expect systematically reality-driven behavior from knowledgeable agents, and they have no particular expectation about how ignorant agents are going to act. With decoupling, mind readers can expect behavior that systematically reflects a more varied array of content, including content drawn from past perception, which is now at odds with current conditions, as in the unwitnessed transfer task, and content expressed verbally by agents in situations where we don't necessarily take what they say as an expression of knowledge. The capacity to think about decoupled content enables separate rational treatment of the question of what's happening in reality beyond the agent and the question of what the agent will do or say. And that enables concrete predictions about what agents will do when they have false beliefs. So belief attribution gains new value among agents who are sharing mental states deliberately. Tomasello observes it's strange that other primates don't learn to attribute belief, because surely they must have seen each other doing stuff on the basis of some kind of misconception. A large part of the explanation here is doubtless that other primates lack the linguistic resources to express and track complex contents beyond immediate physical reality. They also don't get the overtly expressed surprise signals that we need to map what others know. But one reason why this lack of resources is relatively unproblematic for them is that the simpler mapping of knowledge and ignorance serves the practical purposes of mind readers whose main interactions are with simple agents who are themselves incapable of reasoning with decoupled content. Other apes also have very simple motivational profiles. Observed simple agents who have knowledge can be expected to act in ways that predictably fit reality, sometimes accidentally tipping off mind-reading agents to new environmental facts. For example, if I react with obvious interest to a fruit that is behind you over your shoulder. So there is payoff in recognizing that state of knowledge in other agents. But beyond a few very contrived, ecologically rare situations, like the container swap task from last time, the action of simple agents who lack knowledge is going to carry very little fresh information about the world. If another creature didn't see the lemon being moved, it honestly doesn't really matter where he's going to look for it. Something changes when mind readers are tracking not just simple agents who act in response to shared physical reality, but also cognitively complex agents who can think about decoupled contents, express them, reason about them, act strategically. Now the particular commitments of both ignorant and knowledgeable agents become informative of larger patterns of their behavior. Meanwhile, these commitments also become easier to track because they're explicitly broadcast, at least often. Where an ignorant chimpanzee can act on a misconception and waste its time searching in the wrong location, an ignorant human can communicate that misconception, wasting your time too. That's like the foundation of social media, right? Okay. Other animals can send mistaken signals, but only within a range fixed by evolutionary pressures to curb the costs of false alarms. Humans can send a vastly wider array of signals, and our decoupled reasoning enables us to compound earlier mistakes by drawing unwarranted inferences. Conversation is a key action zone for us, for better and for worse. To make it better, each of us needs to construct the best possible model of what others know and believe. And this is a project of utterly daunting computational complexity. And the way we do it is, frankly, astonishing. And we'll talk about that next time.